Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Well, Harambe, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is July 14th. Kylan Ginger is back. This is part two in an ongoing conversation. First show, he interviewed me for a successful dropout. Today, supposed to be more of an interview of him for the School Sucks podcast here. But it turned into such an interesting, revealing, back and forth kind of discussion. Really one of my favorite conversations in recent memory. Covering everything from the law of attraction. Remember that? That movie, The Secret, and all those people with their beads? From the law of attraction to the benefits of marriage. And there's a lot of valuable information for entrepreneurs in between those two things. So we're going to get to that in just a second. But just before we do, 3 weeks from today, we begin day one of A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell. Renegade University and School Sucks Project present A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell. There are still tickets available. If you want to learn more, you can go to schoolsucksproject.com/fadfest or head over to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. And thanks for all the positive feedback about the last episode of the show and the Patreon version of the show with all the little extras and the alternate ending. What did you think of that? And thanks for downloading. We were number 17. We were the 17th most popular show this morning on all of Podomatic, where there's tens of that. I called it Podomatic. Podomatic, the pod for podcast. We were 17 for all shows, tens of thousands of shows hosted on Podomatic. And of course, we were number one in education, which is great. It helps a lot of new people discover the show. They say, I saw you in the top 30 there or on iTunes. What's hot? You know what's hot right now? We are. So that's great. And I owe it to all of you. Please remember to go to successfuldropout.com and check out Kylan's work and the amazing interviews that he does there. I really like working with Kylan. You're going to hear more of him on School Sucks podcast in the future. Okay, everybody, have a great weekend. If you participated in a little Facebook thread that I started about 10 minutes ago called Link Me to Rap Videos Memorable for Their Opulence, you might hear one of your choices in today's show. I appreciate all your contributions, even the ones that were a little disturbing. Haldor posted one called Coco by OT Genesis. And my goodness, this was just a few fellas sitting around a table hollering while they turned cocaine into crack. And this one dude, I guess he's supposed to be the kingpin of this little operation, keeps saying that he's in love with the Coco. So there you go. You know, just like the word success, I guess opulence is somewhat subjective. So anyway, here we go. Here's my conversation with Kylan. I wound it back about 8 minutes into our pre-show discussion. And this is pretty raw. I left it pretty much as is. I hope you don't mind a few fumbles on my part. That being said, thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
I'm in love with the Coco. I'm in love with the Coco. I got it for the Lolo. I'm in love with the Coco.
How's it going, man?
Pretty good. How have you been?
I am living the dream.
Oh, terrific. Usually when people say that, they don't mean it. So.
I've been saying that probably for the last 2-3 years, and it's amazing. Once you start saying it enough, you really do. I can truthfully say it now, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
You know who I hear that most from? It's people who work in retail.
Really? Yeah. they're just being sarcastic.
Or somebody behind the counter at a gas station. So I've tried to think of like a new kind of salutation that doesn't involve asking them how they're doing.
Really? Have you come up with one?
No. I was thinking maybe I just go up to them and go, "Hey, I'm good. I'm doing well. You don't even have to ask how I am today." Or just hello. Because it is like, you know, I think these retail people are onto something. Like, it's a pretty ephemeral interaction that I'm not going to think about them much after that. So maybe they're just being real with me. Like, why even asking, man?
Yeah. You know, there's a few of them I've asked and they've actually said, oh, terrible. You know, I'm doing, you know, horrible today or whatever.
I've heard
and
that too.
I appreciate that more than just the typical, ah, good, because then it actually typically starts a dialogue. I'm like, oh, well, why? And then we talk about a certain situation they had. And then that's actually a conversation I remember. But I guess I'm such a huge believer in affirmations. And then also, you know, humor and kind of a impervious positive attitude, something that doesn't come natural to me, but comes naturally to my business partner, whom I've worked with for 4 or 5 years now. And so I actually picked up the habit from him as just kind of a desperate attempt to, I just need more positivity in my life. I'm not a pessimist, but I'd consider myself more of a realist.
Right.
And I have an ability to kind of get to the facts, understand all the things that could go wrong and prepare for the worst, hope for the best kind of thing. But oftentimes that leads to, at my worst moments, being really pessimistic and negative. And so, and also one of my favorite movies is The A-Team. And I don't know if you've seen that, the newer one, but
I did see
there's
it.
The scene right in the beginning when he's got all the tires around him and he's got being, you know, they're about to burn him and hang him like alive, you know, and he's just like super positive. He's just like, I just know that that's one of the things he says. He's like, doesn't get any better than this. I'm living the dream. And I just thought that was hilarious. So, but yeah, man, how's the community coming along? The School Sucks community and the podcast and everything.
Oh, things have just been on fire the last week or so. Cause I just went out to, Oregon and did, Unregistered podcast with Thaddeus Russell. He built very quickly. He's been on Rogan. He's been on like Dave Rubin and what's another big one? The Gavin McGinnis Show. So he's got a lot of exposure in his podcast.
I love Gavin McGinnis.
Yeah, yeah. His podcast became like really popular really fast. So I flew out there, did his show with him, and got like 30,000 downloads in a couple days, which is great. And my audience, jeez. I just cut together like an extended version of it with like a lot of behind the scenes stuff. So my audience is pretty excited right now. They thought the interview went really well. We talked about a lot of personal stuff. And this is actually the first thing I've done since I got back from there. Things have been really busy, but great over the last couple weeks. Made a lot of good new connections with some really exciting people. So life is living
so
the dream.
So you're doing another...
Living the dream, man.
That's right, man. So you're doing another event with Thaddeus in August?
Yeah, it's called The Weekend with Thaddeus Russell, and we're going to bring my audience together with him in kind of like a small, intimate setting, and we're going to do a bunch of discussion and probably some debate. It's going to be like a seminar.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna have to look forward to that. I'm curious. What's kind of your? Do you have any idea what your kind of age demographic is, or demographic is as far as age goes?
Well, originally, you know, I was shooting to get. I mean, I was naive 8 years ago, and I didn't know that no high school kids would be looking for podcasts. They'd be looking at YouTube, which was kind of new, and like even producing regular content for YouTube was not there weren't many serial media creators on YouTube at that point. And so I made the show with this voice for like high school age kids who were frustrated, but the audience very quickly became adults. Fortunately, it's a lot of adults who have their own kids or have a lot of frustration about their own school experience. But you know, it's kind of with this this undertone to the show that this is about this is like a time capsule we're making for young people to discover someday.
Interesting.
So adults are listening now. Adults are mostly supporting the show, but and it's made to be accessible, I think, to like a younger audience. But most people in the audience are adults, and like I said, a lot of parents and a lot of people who just want, you know, more opportunities for personal growth or self-improvement in their own lives. They're really interested in things like entrepreneurship and sort of breaking the mold of both secondary school and college.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I've noticed a bit more of an older mix in my audience just since we interacted last, and then I put some thought into who your audience might be, and I was assuming probably more, you know, adults. My audience tends to be more, their average age is like 16 to 25, and I guess that was pretty much on purpose, but I didn't put much thought into the medium. I just knew I wanted to start a podcast. I think a lot more young people probably listen to podcasts nowadays, but it's still not, you know, the most popular. I think YouTube is still a big one, which is why I'm trying to at least throw some of the audio up on YouTube, if not some more videos later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good route too. A lot of people are doing that, and it can be, you know, an extra, maybe sometimes it's just a few hundred extra views on a podcast, but they're probably good views if people are willing to sit there and just listen to something on YouTube, which apparently a lot of people do. So I keep telling myself, like, I have to do some re-editing because sometimes I use, like, licensed music in my shows. And, you know, you can get away with that in podcasting, but you really – YouTube is a bit more stringent with that. So I just haven't, like, taken the time to, like, re-edit the shows and take that music out. But, I mean, it's not a hard thing to do. I could definitely do it.
Yeah, that's true. I should probably pay attention to that too. Well, sweet, man. How do you want to do this, or what's the?
We're just going to have a conversation like we did last time, but it's going to be more focused on you answering questions about yourself. But it's you know, it's going to be just a light and lively kind of discussion.
Cool. Kind of like we've already been doing. Let's just keep it going.
Absolutely. You just want to start right there?
Fine with me. I think people love the authenticity.
Indeed. So. The way I wanted to start the podcast today was actually to tell you that your show made me run. It made me, like, I go out and I walk in the morning, and I had your show in a, I forget who it was, maybe Derek McGill. He was a guest not too long ago, right? Yep. And your intro is just so awesome. I think it had like a Rocky clip, the episode that I was listening to. And then that music starts. And I was out walking. I just tried to do a quick 20-minute walk to get some steps in the morning, and I started running, man. Like, I just said, this is the moment.
Yes.
And now, am I a runner? No. Did that start a running habit? No. But there was just something like super energizing about your show. And another reason why I really like discovering it is because you make explicit the kinds of messages that I want to extract from people who are entrepreneurs, because I've been having conversations with lots of entrepreneurs lately. You just put it all out on the table. Your show is called Successful Dropout. You lay it all out, who you are, and what you're about on the About page, and you make it clear in every single one of these discussions that, you know, people can have this success without going down that higher education path a lot of the time. If they know themselves, I mean, sure, what we're talking about is not for everybody. I ask myself if it's for me sometimes. And then I realize that I am kind of doing it. But there's a lot of second guessing, and it's, you know, shows like yours and conversations with other entrepreneurs that remind me, you know, I'm on a good path for myself, but I appreciate the way you do it. You make it extra clear for young people that they do have options beyond the funnel they're led down through secondary school.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. Glad I was able to make you run, man. That's sweet. You know, probably the most fun part about editing the episodes, because I still do that myself, is those intros. And I try to switch them up every month or two. And that's what I was trying to get at. I know there's some licensed stuff in there, because most of them are movie clips, right?
Yeah.
And I think the current one I have now is from I think it's from Catch Me If You Can, and it's Leonardo DiCaprio, and he's talking about the two little mice that fall into a bucket of cream, and they churn and churn and churn until they turn into butter and walk out, and I don't know. So that's at the beginning of this of right. These current episodes that are coming out. If people want to go listen to that, but but yeah, man, with the podcast, like from the get go, I just I knew I wanted to start a podcast, and somewhere I had just read and I kind of innately felt that some of the best podcasts and movements were the ones that kind of created a bit of a stir and that were really authentic and unique and kind of gritty in some ways and so yeah. And bold. And so that's why, even down to, I have kind of a signature soft red color, I guess I would call it, that, you know, is all over the website and stuff. Like, I picked that for branding purposes because I wanted something that was bold, and I wanted to make a bold statement, and that statement was that you can be successful, incredibly successful too, in business and in life without a college degree, in many cases without even a high school diploma. And then just get people on the show and get down to the grit of it all. Being a dropout myself, I've had some incredibly gritty times in my life, and through a lot of mistakes, a lot of heartache, a lot of times, you know, I've had, you know, panic attacks, and then a lot of like fun successes. And now I'm kind of coming to this point where it's finally like all this hard work over, you know, since I dropped out is kind of starting to pay off, but that journey is just such an interesting one, and I have so many crazy stories, and I just love being able to pull out other dropouts and opt outs, and a lot of them, even the people I have on my show, a lot of them even have degrees.
Right.
But it's those stories of the struggle and people discovering themselves. And, you know, I think, I don't know who said it, but somebody said, you know, the basis of all, like education or learning is self knowledge. So that might've been Gatto, you'd probably know, but yeah, man.
I'm not sure. That's a great quote. What's the quote again? Best you know it?
And as I'm remembering it, it's the basis of all education is self-knowledge, or the basis of all learning is self-knowledge, something like that. Mm. Basically, that it helps. The biggest advice I give to anybody on my show who's reaching out about, like, what should I do? Should I drop out? Should I not? You got to know yourself. You've got to, and I encourage people as a mechanism to do this, spend some time alone. Being alone comes naturally to me. According to personality tests, I'm an extrovert, but what do they call it? It's like in between an extrovert and an introvert. It's like I don't know. I can do both, but I really enjoy being alone, and that's given me a lot of time to be introspective, and to really wrestle with some internal questions. Sure. And then when I try stuff, I find out what my strengths and my weaknesses are, and that's allowed me to really understand myself. And from there, I get a lot more clarity about where, you know, what goals to set next, and what to put my time into, and what businesses to build. And the reality is that throughout, you know, K through 12, and even into college, individuals have very little time to do that, because you're just constantly bombarded with, you know, here's what you're supposed to do, here's what you're supposed to learn.
Mm-hmm. Taken out of self.
Exactly. So I think it's surprising to me, and I was homeschooled,
right,
most of my life, and we grew up in the woods, and so I had a lot of time to do this and to hike and spend time alone and really discover who I was. And it's surprising to me how little time people who are more indoctrinated into the system, how little time they have to do that. And at the end of the day, it you notice people talk to me and they've got just this like dissatisfaction with where they are, and what, you know, some of them are in high school, a lot of them are in college. There's this like deep dissatisfaction, and that's why they're reaching out and going out of their way to talk to me like a stranger. Mm-hmm. About it, but they're so confused, like they have no idea what to do next. And they're literally, the biggest question I get is these vague, like, I don't like where I'm at right now, what do I do? And they're not giving me any information about like what their strengths and weaknesses are, what their skills are, what they're innately curious about. And so those are the questions I ask next. Like, tell me what you're curious about, man. Or what do you have career capital in? Or what are you building? What do you enjoy doing? What work do you love to do? Tell me those things, and then I can give you a little bit more direction and provide you with some resources.
Right. Yeah, so many paths just opened up in front of us, Kylan, for this discussion. It reminds me that I forgot to qualify when we are in our last conversation where you were interviewing me more for your show, that I was a dropout. It took me, I was in my sixth year of higher education before I left a master's program for education, educational leadership. I was going to be like a public school administrator. And I thought that it was just this one day where one of our assignments was to do a puppet show that I said I'm not feeling it. I don't feel like this is serious work. But you know,
come on, man, you like puppets?
I do. It just didn't seem like the right place for it. I felt it, like the whole experience was demeaning, and the puppet show was just a representation of the demeaning experience that master's totally. Program was. But I remember when we were talking before, I said something. I wasn't really thrilled with how I said it, but I was kind of getting at this idea that you're talking with people who just feel unsatisfied. They don't like what they were doing. As I've gotten to a place in life that I like I said in the last show, I've kind of superimposed this vision or this wisdom on my younger self at all of these steps where I realized something had to change. And if I'm honest with myself, I realized that it wasn't actually there, right? Like I just said, I don't like this. Let's figure out what's wrong. Right. So it was much more confusing. It was much more unstable. When I left the master's program, like I was in a bad relationship. My job was stressing me out. It was like almost to a breaking point. I wasn't taking care of myself. I was drinking too much. It was just like a house of cards that was going to come down one way or another. So obviously it's cliche to say it's not a clear path from where you are to success. But for me, it was a real mess. And, you know, when I think about you in 2009, a freshman in college, dropping out of school, I say, did he know what he was doing? But now, remembering that you had this pretty unique experience in your own education, in your own formative years, maybe you did know what you were doing in a way that mm-hmm. I just didn't, because nothing had prepared me to have that kind of self-direction or that self-ownership. I pretty much had to invent a story for myself later about what I was doing and why. But let's go back to 2009 when you made that decision to that college. I mean, right at the beginning, you decided mm-hmm. college wasn't right for you. How confident were you that you were on the right path for yourself?
You know, I was actually pretty confident, and I know that that's more, you know, rare, like you said. And so I'm constantly, you know, that's a big question that I'm still trying to answer is what was it about my upbringing? And I actually, a lot of the entrepreneurs and individuals I have on my show, I ask this question, you know, why is it, do you think that you turned out the way you did? And I talk to them about, you know, their history and their parents and the people they hung out with. Because that's as I get questions and emails from listeners of the show, I'm really curious to understand, you know, what their background was and use that to kind of paint a picture of where they are now and how likely they are to, you know, is giving them the advice like, yeah, you're dissatisfied with school, you should, you know, go ahead and drop out. You know, is that right. good advice to give this person?
Right.
For me, it was... Oh, I remember the day, you know, the whitewashed like cinder block walls, and I was taking a marketing class. It was a couple months into it, and just basically figuring out that day that all we were doing is studying from the textbook, and the teacher that our professor had zero marketing experience, never worked with a firm, never owned her own business, and I essentially was just like, I could just buy this book and take it home and do the exact same things
sure.
That we're doing here in class. Plus, you know, I knew enough about what was going on in the marketing and business world to understand that this was like an old book. I think it was, you know, published in like 2002 or something. It was 2009. And it's like, this industry progresses a lot faster. And so I know that a lot of this is archaic information. And so, that plus I hated the environment and just was generally dissatisfied on a deeper level just caused me to drop out almost immediately. It was basically I went home that day, that night. I was like, yep, tomorrow I'm just going to go down there and tell them to not count on me coming back to class. And that's what I did without giving a ton of thought about what to do next. I will say this, I had a little bit of savings and I was still living with my parents, at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I would highly suggest that people take kind of an accounting of their financial situation and maybe their living situation. In this case, I didn't have to worry about like being on the street or going bankrupt. You know, I knew I had some time to, you know, figure things out. And I did. It wasn't long after that that I actually started working at my local church as my church's youth pastor. Mm-hmm. And that went on for the next 2 years. And I guess that's something to point out too, is because the first thing I did, Brett, when I did drop out, is I looked back on my life and took kind of an accounting of, you know, what have I been involved in the most up to this point? What am I really passionate about? And what's the work I enjoy doing? And one of the things I realized is that I've been involved in my church for a very long time. From a really young age, I had been, you know, serving at the church. This was in the absence of going to regular, you know, formal school, the people and the friends that I had at church were like, that was like my school, basically. That's where I went to socialize, and we went to events there. And so I was very involved. I was very musically inclined and did a lot of the music program and stuff there. So I had a lot of hours put in, a lot of career capital is the term I like to use. And so that's basically what I went to first. And it turned out that, you know, luckily the previous youth pastor had just left. There was kind of this hole to fill. And I basically called my pastor up and kind of pitched myself and just said, you know, try me out for a month or two or three. I can't remember how long it was, but try me out. And if you like the results you see, then maybe hire me on full time. And so at 19 years old, I started making a salary doing work I loved, essentially, and also learning how to build an organization, which is more of a volunteer organization in ministry, mm-hmm. which I'm not, you know, really involved with anymore. But man, that's what a learning experience for a future entrepreneur, because you don't have the carrot and stick of a job or a salary or firing people. It's all volunteer, and you still have to get people to show up and be passionate and make things happen. So that was just a good combination for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, so in my audience, very mixed attitude towards religion. I would even venture a guess that most people probably have negative experiences about whatever religious upbringing they had. Mm-hmm. I was very resentful about it for a long time. But what you get from that experience that you're describing is a sense of community. And I think what comes with a sense of community face to face is accountability. You know, and responsibility and self responsibility and responsibility to other people. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately. Someone actually put up a video of like a clip from a show recently where I was musing about tradition and the death of community. I feel like that's something that I watched. I mean, you're 10 years younger than I am, but I feel like that's something that I watched mm-hmm. from the time that I was a little kid until the time that I was, you know, living on my own and starting a professional career, where at that young age, even if people, you know, had like political conflicts, the community, I grew up in a little town in New Hampshire, and the community had priority over those not so empowering divisions that seem to absolutely rule the world in many social interactions today, right? People prioritize that almost as a form of entertainment. While all that stuff did exist in the background, community was the priority in the world that I grew up in, and it produced, you know, a really decent environment for me mm-hmm. and my two younger brothers to be raised in. So I definitely I see the value in that, and I see how that if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like that gave you a kind of framework to, you know, take responsibility for yourself, but also, as I've heard you talk about, and I think we talked about in the last conversation, learn accountability to others.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I can clarify, you know, for your listeners, if bringing them up to speed on my life and where my beliefs are, I've come a long way in terms of where my beliefs were at when I was 19 to now being 27. I'm constantly trying to question my beliefs and my assumptions and my reasoning. Mm. I think it's a really healthy thing to do, and I enjoy kind of the intellectual acrobatics of it all. Mm-hmm. So religion was definitely one of those things. I mean, it was probably when I was around 22, 23, I basically threw Christianity as it was that, you know, the Christianity I'd grown up with and been exposed to, I basically threw it all out the window and started from scratch And I gotta admit, I gotta get back on it because I'm still not sure about a lot of things I was sure about, you know, earlier. If I had to give you the Cliff Notes version, I think I'm coming to the point where I can logically kind of prove to myself that the universe was probably intelligently designed by some entity. But as far as how much they're involved in the world today, I'm not sure. And I think, you know, things like prayer, I think, are just basically the mechanism of things like, affirmations,
feeding the subconscious,
vision casting and stuff. And
yeah,
exactly. You know, I think that the world generally tends to give you what you put into it. You know, the universe gives you back what you put into it, you know, in general, I've noticed. And
yeah. And I was kind of frustrated looking back at how that got, it was like definitely like 10 years ago, it was getting a really new agey treatment. But it really is a matter mm-hmm. of perspective and where you train yourself to point your attention. I have told this story, I think, on my show before about the people that I used to work with. They were always miserable and only bad things ever seemed to happen to them. They would come in to work complaining about what happened when they weren't in work. Work would suck that day. They would have a bad time. Bad things would happen to them related to, you know, the kids we taught. And that cycle would repeat. And I didn't really counsel any of them on this, even though it created a more frustrating environment for me. But that's where they were pointing their attention. They were only, and they would even spin positive things into negative things. So it has a lot to do with, you know, how we program ourselves, I think, through the way that we mm-hmm. have that internal dialogue.
Yeah. So, I mean, all that to say, like, it's tough for me to even call myself, you know, a Christian today. I honestly kind of hope that I get back to a point where I can believe with integrity what I did before, because, and to bring it back to your original point, Brett, the community was so vital to shaping who I am. And that's one thing, you know, about at least the churches and the more like faith-based circles that I grew up around really shaped me into the kind of person I am today. And I really like who I am. And I think a lot of other people like who I am. Mm-hmm. And when I have kids, that's going to be a real challenge for me, I think, to find an environment that is consistent outside of at least the kind of Christian environments I was exposed to that gives them the same benefits that I got. Because it does come down to this community and this kind of fellowship you have with like-minded people that are also always pushing each other to be better. And boy, that can get really toxic really quick when guilt, you know, comes yep. into the picture and yep. stuff. But if you can get into a community and especially I think some of the basics of Christianity, kind of what you would say Jesus taught, say in like Matthew 5 and stuff, those I think are universal truths that most human beings can agree with and live by. And it's like, if you can cut out all the garbage and all the religion and come down to some of these basic truths, like loving, you know, your neighbor, and, you know, then I think that's where it can be really powerful. And the community, again, like you said, is so important in that environment. So that is something that I still do appreciate about Christianity and the Christian faith, is that community and environment. I don't know. When I have kids, it's like I said, it's going to be really difficult for me to want to find another environment where they'll be able to get those same kinds of benefits. But like you said, it can just turn toxic really quick, especially at least in the world where we're entrepreneurs and we're building things and we're solving problems. There can be a real tendency in Christianity to blame too many things on a God, to, if you have a bad day, to blame it on the fact that maybe you didn't read your Bible at the beginning of the day, or to, I'm trying to buy a house right now. I do a little bit of real estate. I'm trying to buy a house from this gal, and her house is going to foreclosure. It already has, actually. So this was last month, and it was going to foreclosure at the end of June. And I'm offering to buy her house from her for basically market value, and she'll be able to get out from under it. She'll have extra cash to move on and start, you know, something else, and I make a little money. So, you know, it all works, but basically she has to agree to sell her house to me so it doesn't go to foreclosure, and that's a much worse process for her to go through.
Right.
And, you know, she just kept saying that she was praying for something to happen. And I was friends with her on Facebook, and there was all these posts to friends and family about how they were going through trying times and God was testing them. And they, you know, they needed prayer for this and that, and they were looking for a miracle. And here I am, like, messaging her. I have the money to buy your house. I want to buy your house from you, and you can get out from this under this debt.
Yeah.
You know, pay it all off, have extra. And so I think, you know, too many people replace, you know, personal responsibility, you know, with God or even prayer sometimes. And that was a big problem that I had too. But
amen on that. We're told God is pretty powerful, and communities built around God are pretty powerful as well. So you do start to see a kind of disconnection from self, not much respect for individuality or, you know, the assertion of individuals, because it's, you know, maybe out of sync at times with the community. So what rises up, and I can remember the feeling that this created, even though when I was a young Catholic boy, I probably couldn't have put the words to it. This judgment is used as almost a kind of policing of community. And with that, you know, especially if it's from adults to children, that translates into shame. I mean, school, you can say all the same things, I think, about the school experience, but you have individuals who are really apprehensive about asserting themselves, which is also, you know, part of being responsible and developing a purpose and then, you know, living a life that is in integrity with that purpose.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. It's the tendency with somebody who is overschooled is typically to look to people that are more credentialed than they are for direction and self-value and stuff like that. And honestly, I think people that are too religioned, I guess, can tend to get the same way. And I just remember, at least when I was growing up, if you started talking too much about the personal power that you kind of have within you and you're with through affirmations and just personal response, you started talking too much about that stuff. You were kind of looked at as maybe somebody who should rely on God more.
Right.
I remember the book, The Secret, and then, you know, there's the documentary and everything. It's basically
that's
about
what I was thinking. Yeah. That's what I was
the law
thinking
of
about.
Attraction. Yes. You know, which back then when that came out, man, at least in my circles, that was like super new agey. And I remember I had a copy of it by my bed at my parents' house. And we had some guests over that were kind of guest speakers at our church, and they stayed in my room and I slept on the couch. And when I had my room again, they had left a note in that book, you know, where my bookmark had been, basically warning me about this and how it could kind of turn me away from God and, you know, too much reliance on self and all that stuff. I also had a book about Obama, since he had just become president, and they've left a similar note in there for me. but it's like nowadays that, like, everybody, even most Christians that I know, are talking about that, the law of attraction. You know, it's such a powerful thing, which you tend to focus on and put times toward and speak out. You know, it tends to bring more of that into your life. And so
yeah, but it is the story of those frustrated employees, right? You will recognize things that relate to basically where you point your attention, and it's not there's no magnetism of bad things coming to you because you have a bad attitude. That's a personal perceptive thing. That's your comfort zone. You like things that suck, so you'll find them, right? That allows you to exist in a familiar place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another interesting point to that I think some people overlook sometimes is people say, okay, so it's all about you know, your words are very important. What you kind of speak and think about often, you tend to attract a lot of that into your life. So people think, okay, well, I don't want to be poor, so I'm just going to say, like, I don't want to be poor all over again, or I don't want to be obese, or, you know, overweight. I don't want to be sad. And they start saying kind of the negative version of this affirmation, and really it doesn't make much of a change. And, you know, I can't point to any science behind it. I just know that when I write down a goal, if I look back through, you know, I write goals every year, and now I can look back at say, you know, 8-9 years or so of goal writing and then what's actually been accomplished in relation to those goals. When I write down something that I want to accomplish, just writing it down once makes it like 10% more likely to happen. Writing it down multiple times a year, you know, like 30% more likely. Doing that in addition to saying it is like 80 to 85% more likely. And you've got to say kind of the positive version of it. If I just continue to write down and say like, I don't want to be poor, I don't want to be poor. It's like, you're probably going to be poor.
Right.
You know, write down, you know, wealth flows to me in mountains of abundance, I think is what Tony Robbins says. So just an interesting point to that.
If we can, at this point, let's jump back to something that I bookmarked. You said this maybe about 15 minutes ago when you're talking about, I bookmarked a couple of things here. I'm looking at my notes. But the one that I wanted to start with is we pick up with you leaving this community and moving into a college. And you talked about studying marketing. What did you go there seeking? Like, why did you decide that that was the place?
Well, I went to college basically because that's what you were supposed to do. And I think there's still kind of a widespread epidemic there of kids that are so indoctrinated into the formal schooling system all throughout high school. And they still have parents that went through that whole process that when they do reach this really interesting transition where they're out of high school, they're kind of adults, they can sort of go do what they want to do with their lives for the most part. The majority of them, it's like, okay, well, college is obviously the next step. That's still what everybody, the media, what everybody's telling them is that, okay, you know, go to college, get a good job, or get a good degree, get a good job, work for 30 years in the same job and retire and play golf all day or something like that. And so that was just for me, especially back in 2009, that's just, well, I guess college is next. So I'm going to go do that. And marketing, I just knew I'd been interested in business, business-like things. That's, I kind of saw myself as doing that eventually. And so marketing out of the classes I could see on this piece of paper, that's what I wanted to take. And to be clear, I didn't really go in with any degree prospects. Like I didn't know what I wanted to get as far as a degree was. I was like, well, I'll figure that out in the first few months and I'll just start taking classes that I would be interested in. And marketing was one of those. And surprisingly, I guess I do a little bit of marketing, but it's not like a huge interest even today. So much of that, I guess is what I'm saying, is it was just like, okay, you kind of just do the next thing that you're supposed to do because society says that, I guess, which for me was rare. I've always been a little bit more of a rebel and a contrarian. I really enjoy that. And so that was just a little departure from, I think, my true self. And it didn't last very long, obviously.
Right, exactly. So this is like such a slow pitch softball question, considering the respective missions of both of our shows. But do you feel like the educational freedom that you had for pretty much all of your life? Well, actually, no, that's a good question, because maybe you said you were homeschooled. That doesn't necessarily translate to educational freedom. But do you feel like it was something about the way education happened for you as a youngster that made that experience in a college so quickly repulsive, while most people just drudge through it for, you know, until they can't take it anymore, until they just basically self-destruct either with partying or bad grades and fail out, or until they do get that degree? Well, how was that for you?
No, I think it's a great question. I think unschooling, personally, if you kind of break down the what each means, unschooling, I think, is better mechanism for what we're talking about than than homeschooling, because sometimes, like you said, homeschooling can turn into not real education. For me, I guess I was lucky enough to, my dad also worked from home, building kind of, I watched him work from home building a business that he was really passionate about, around work that he loved to do. And so that was really eye-opening. And of course, my mom stayed home and taught us, and she still taught us from basic, you know, curriculums and, you know, textbooks that she would buy and stuff. So it definitely was kind of structured, and a lot of it like, okay, you have to learn this because other kids your age are learning it. But I think maybe what contributed to a lot of my mentality, making it really easy to just kind of drop out so soon, was, I think it was, I mean, a lot of it was just the environment. And like, we lived in the mountains, we didn't have a lot of internet access. I was really forced to come up with a lot of, I read a lot, first of all, but then I was really forced to come up with a lot of different ways to entertain myself. And in addition to that, I had a lot of free time. And I think this is the key, and this is why unschooling is so great. I had a lot of free time to kind of direct my innate curiosities. Mm-hmm. And so I've got very used to, that's interesting. I'm going to take an hour and I'm going to go check that out. And the next day, oh, that's still really interesting. I'm going to spend more time on it today. And now I'm going to really get into this thing because I really enjoy it. And I don't have anybody really telling me, like, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You can't make a career out of that. That's not worthwhile to learn about. I didn't really have anybody telling me that. And so I got so used to doing that, that then when it did come time to where people were like, don't you really think, though, that you should probably, you know, do this or that? It was just like, no, I've gotten along fine the last, you know, 19 years of my life doing basically what I want to do. So I'm not about to, you know, quit now or, you know, distrust myself or my innate desires now. And that's basically been my philosophy all through life. If you look at, oh gosh, I've done a lot. I mean, it was after ministry, I worked in construction and then I was in the military. And then after that, I started a company in one industry, and then I started another company in another industry, and then I did that again. And then, I was, you know, a musician in a touring band for a long time. And throughout all these different ventures, I always had people saying, like, but don't you think that this way is better than this way, and that maybe what you're doing is, and I was like, no, like, I'm, you know, I can truthfully look back right now, Brett, throughout the past, 27 years, and just say, like, I've truly done everything that I've ever been interested in doing. I've pursued, you know, tasted, tried, or accomplished everything that I've had an innate desire to do. And that's an incredible feeling. It really is. It doesn't mean that, well, you know, a lot of times that can make life pretty tough. There's some, definitely, if you listen to my podcast, I get really real in a couple different episodes where things just, you know, I literally wanted to curl up in a ball and die sometimes, but
yeah,
because of that kind of mentality. But ultimately, it's made me a better person and a stronger person. And I think that's something that people just take for granted. The risk is so important, like taking risks and being true to yourself and failure. And people are indoctrinated to think that failure is this thing to be avoided. You get a big, F, red F with a circle or a X through it or something on your paper when you fail, and your classmates look at you and they're like, oh, this guy must be stupid. He's going to be in the short bus or whatever next year. And
mm-hmm.
We're so indoctrinated to think that way, when that's so important to finding out what you want to do in life and living a fulfilled life. At the end of the day, you have to fail. You should look forward to mistakes and look forward to failure, because it's an opportunity to learn. And when you learn, it's just another step towards inevitable success. And so,
have any, from the best of your memory, have any of your guests on Successful Dropout given advice similar to the advice that I gave when I was on your show, which was just totally obviously from my own experience, where I talked about avoiding glamorizing failure? I mean, I realized that, and not even necessarily failure, but like hardship or sacrifice related to the pursuit of some kind of purpose. As I look back at my 30s, I say, maybe I spent too much time in stressful and difficult situations that I didn't necessarily have to spend that time in if I hadn't been telling myself a story that, you know, living beneath my means or beneath the level that I knew I was capable of reaching was okay, because I was making a sacrifice in pursuit of a purpose that was really, really important. Because if you, I think for a lot of us, if you come to a realization that, you know, maybe we or me were wrong about that purpose, that's kind of a difficult feeling to look back on. So I don't know if any of your other guests, I know a lot of the people that you have on the show are fairly young, had any caution about the embrace of failure.
That's a So I think we should just go a little bit deeper into this, because you're jogging my memory now. You did say that, and I remember it being very unique. I don't think anybody else has brought that up. And I remember it being – it's definitely very, very true. And I suppose you can get to a point where – so you're talking about glamorizing failure or mistakes – in while they're actually happening, basically
living in it. Maybe, you know what, maybe other people don't actually do it. I mean, I just remember, I've heard this story from, you know, the super rich and want to help you get rich types, like Kiyosaki was the example that I think I used in your show. Where he talks about, you know, look at me now, but you wouldn't believe the struggles that I used to endure. And if you find yourself enduring those struggles, it's like you're in the middle of this fairy tale that ends in success someday, but you're at this, you're kind of relegating yourself to this crappy part of the fairy tale. Now that might just be me. I don't know. Maybe other people.
Well, do you think that you were doing it because? Do you think that the action of you glamorizing it, say in the moment, was keeping you there longer than you should have been? Maybe.
I think so, because if you don't, there's this balance, right? That I guess has to be achieved, where the situation sucks enough that you want to get out of it, and you're also you have your wits about you enough that you can learn from it. And I think maybe. You know, another one of my bookmarks is when you were asking people on your show about what it was about each one of them where they thought they had it. They had what it took to do what you talk about on your show, to break out of the mold and set off on one's own course. And I'm wondering if this is part of that, if this is an important attribute that you can balance, that you can recognize the difficulty of a situation. You put yourself in this situation because you feel like it's important, but you're aware of the difficulties and still able to learn from them and move forward.
Interesting. You see, and I think a lot of the guests on my show, you know, many of them kind of had this innate ability to be like, I'm going to make it, you know, no matter what. So I feel comfortable dropping out. Mm-hmm. A lot of them just dropped out because it was like, I hate this. I'm going to stop. And they didn't put much forethought into it. And typically those stories end up with them hitting absolute rock bottom at some point. And it's like when you hit rock bottom, you can't go much lower, and there's, you know, nowhere else to go but up. Or for a lot of them, there was some sort of pressure in their life, which forced – maybe it's like you have a kid or something. It's amazing how many people turn into millionaires after they have kids, or, you know, or at least get a good job, because there's this pressure. You know, I think back, you know, some of the best successes I've had and some of the best, say, money that I've made has come right after I'm basically broke. Mm-hmm. Because it gets me to this point where it's like, well, I have no choice but to make it now. I can't mess around. I've got to pick something, stick with it. And it's amazing how your brain just turns on and lights up at that point. But yeah, it's really because I guess I'm trying to put myself in a situation now where, you know, currently there's not any kind of situation or failure going on where I'm just like, oh, this is the worst. I can't wait to get out of this. But I'm trying to think if something did happen, which inevitably it will. We're starting, you know, thinking of starting a couple new ventures here, and so inevitably it will. The powerful thing for me is to be able to look back and be like, well, see all of these other times when the odds felt like they were, you know, against me, and we were dealing with failure and mistakes, and we kind of made it out. And so now moving forward, because of this life experience, I can be I can worry less. I can, there's less anxiety. Whereas when you're just starting out, I feel like you don't have as much life experience to draw from. So I remember like talking to my dad and being like, were you ever at a spot where you were about to go bankrupt in your mm-hmm. first business? People were mad at you, and you owed people thousands of dollars you can't pay. and you're just like, well, yeah, I guess I was, but and maybe I still am some points. And he's, you know, 50, and it's like, but it doesn't get me as much as it used to because that life experience. But it's interesting because I've never heard somebody. I guess I've never looked at somebody and felt like they're just glamorizing this terrible situation they're in because that's what all the Robert Kiyosaki's and I don't know, Ty Lopez, if he's ever had a bad day in his life, you know, that's what, you know, they're all saying. I suppose that could happen to something, but I maybe it is, you know, more unique. I would just, yeah.
Glamorizing is a strong word.
Would be, if you were feeling that way, you must have been really aware of the kind of failure success cycle of the entrepreneur. At least I would assume if you know, you were able to, I know you said glamorize was a strong word, but if you were able to glamorize, you know, failure or the position you were at the time, you know, being able to understand where you were in the bigger picture, I guess, of mm-hmm. of life and the whole process. Cause man, I just was not able to do that. It was like, this is the end of the world.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting that you say that, because what's happening for me right now is that the conversation that I had on my last podcast was me being interviewed a lot about like growing up and school and my childhood. And that's kind of smashing into this conversation right here. As you told the story about your dad working from home and modeling, building a business. My dad was a business owner as well and an entrepreneur, and was really, really successful by the time he was my age. And when he was my age, I was, 10, 11, 12, around there. And he decided to, you know, take the success that he'd had in the past and apply it to a new venture, a kind of distressed company in an industry that he really knew nothing about. And within a year or two, he was bankrupt. He had lost all his savings, our college money. He had been investigated by the EPA. He had been arrested for trespassing because of problems that he had. They were renting a building where they were running this printed circuit board company, and he was in some kind of conflict with the building owner. A lock had been put on their warehouse, and they broke the lock and tried to move all their stuff out in the middle of the night. This is the story that I was told. And I remember my mom. So I'm like 12 or 13 years old. And this is a time where it's like, hey, family, we need money. You know, I got to have the clothes that keep me hip in middle school. I'm going to be thinking about a car in a few years. Like, and this is especially after experiencing, only ever knowing affluence in my life, like suddenly confronted with this, I guess at the beginning of my teen years, I'm just thinking, this is an interview of you, but I'm just thinking like,
no, this is great.
That, oh my goodness, you know, maybe there is some residue of that. I mean, I'm kind of reflecting back on my attitude over the last decade about a lot of ventures that I've been involved in, and being too comfortable with the status quo, even if it is not outright failure. Mm-hmm. But interesting.
That's great, man. Your dad sounds like a boss, first of all. But I would totally attribute a lot of that to that experience. I mean, man, I think if, you know, my dad did pretty well. Granted, he's definitely the kind of entrepreneur that takes very calculated risk. You know, he's not going to say bet the farm. And I'm implying anything about your dad, but you know, he's not the kind of person that would bet the farm on anything. And so, you know, his there weren't a lot of huge risks he took, and if he took them, they're very calculated. So mostly his trajectory just went up and up as I grew up, and so that's all I was exposed to. So when it came down to facing some real failure, you know, I remember talking to him, and then he told me all the stories about when he was before he had me, it was actually kind of a similar situation. At one point, his business partner basically kicked him out of the business or wasn't paying the bills or something, and their landlord locked him out of their office. And so he showed up to work one time with all their employees, and the door was locked and his keys didn't work. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, that was
like a bunch of people and you can't get into your own office. So definitely, you know, failure there. But I guess I just wasn't exposed to that, but I could totally see how you could, you know, get too comfortable in that stage. And what I'd have to say to anybody who might be doing that is just, as much as I think you should realize that, you know, failure is all, you know, it's all a part of the process, you do have a duty to be successful. And I did a whole podcast episode on this. You should view success and success is relative, of course. Everybody has their own idea, but success, you should view success to you as a duty and put it right in the same category in your mind as, you know, paying the bills and putting a roof over your head. Like it's your job to be successful. And the sooner you start thinking that way, the better. Because man, if you don't do what you were uniquely, you know, what you're supposed to do, not only are you missing out, but think of all the other people that are missing out. And so I think back to all the times when I could have thrown in the towel or quit or just, okay, let's, you know, bankruptcy it is and let's start, you know, something else. It's like, because we kind of pushed through and tried to get out of that season as fast as possible, now we look back and 3 years later or so, we've impacted thousands of customers and private investors and ourselves and our families, and we've built, you know, products and services that are making the world a better place. And so literally, if I would have just decided to kind of stay put, I would have negative – I view it as almost – you know, I'm taking something away from somebody. I would have just kind of negatively impacted a bunch of people. I wouldn't have been able to positively impact them. I mean, imagine how pissed off you would be if your iPhone, you know, or your Bluetooth speakers, you know, ceased to exist. All those things exist because, you know, somebody viewed it as a duty to be successful. So,
yeah, absolutely. It's interesting too, because I think that now I'm lasering in on more of what I was experiencing. It wasn't failure, right? I definitely thought there were examples of failure being glamorized or failure being okay if you're on like a mission that's really important, that's really, really going to change the world. What it is a comfort zone, especially like once I have reached this point where I fulfilled my responsibilities to myself, that I have the money that I need to live indoors, to drive a reliable car, to eat quality food, to be able to, you know, have recreational opportunities and adventures, then it's kind of a sticking point, right, where this comfort zone develops. I like what I do. I feel like what I do is important and that it helps people. But how do you break through that? You know, how do you say, okay, well, everything is taken care of and this is all really satisfying. Right. How do you not get, and maybe your trajectory was just too fast to even like have a pause in a moment like that. Mm-hmm. But for me, that's definitely a comfortable place. And I find myself, you know, contemplating a lot of things right now and even bouncing ideas off other people about how to bust through that and achieve a much higher level of success and exposure and effectiveness with what I'm doing.
Yeah, I totally get that. And the question I would ask is like, it's like, do you need more at that point? I mean, we're all told it's kind of like the school thing. I think most of us are told that by society that success is being a millionaire, success is driving a Tesla, success is being able to build your dream home. And so We all tend to just start to work towards what are mostly they seem to be financial goals most often without really giving much thought into, you know, is this actually the kind of success I'm looking for? And actually, we went way into depth with this in my last interview with a guy named Jimmy Tomczak, and just talking about people have these ideas of success that are mostly pushed onto them by society. And it's all good and well, but there hasn't been as much thought as there should be. And so they end up living these lifestyles, or when they make it, you know, quote unquote, make it, it's not the actual kind of success they wanted. So for example, for the longest time, I had a lot of, I guess, financial goals. I wanted to make, you know, X amount of dollars by X date. Mm-hmm. And so I was working my butt off and working very hard, and that was kind of the focus. And a few years ago, I switched that, and so now the majority of my goals are lifestyle based, because for me, how I spend my time and who I spend my time with is a lot more important than how much money I make.
That's,
and I find that as a result, the money just seems to come. But it was like, I'll tell you, like, Brett, the most freeing realization that I had probably 3 months ago, we just moved up to the mountains again. This is where I grew up, and we've lived in the city for 12 years or so. And we just moved up 6 months ago to the mountains, like literally down the street from where I grew up. And this has kind of always been our dream location. We're not in what I would consider to be the house I want to end up in or anything like that yet, but we're in our dream location. And because of the businesses we built, we're able to spend our time pretty much and hang out with, you know, who we want to and spend our time the way we want to. And the other day I was talking to my wife and I was like, you know what, if I made $5 million cash, you know, tomorrow, if it just showed up in my bank account, I don't think my life would change that much. Like I'd make a few more investments. I'd probably purchase one fun kind of recreational vehicle for up there. But besides that, like the way that I spend my time and the people I hang out with, and my day to day, like lifestyle, like the things that we buy at the grocery store and stuff, none of that would change. And we don't live a very, I guess, lavish lifestyle. You know, we have a reliable car. We buy basically only the food that we eat. We like, we're not minimalists, but we live in a, we went from in a bigger house to actually moving up there. And now we live in a, in like an 850 square foot, one or two bedroom, one bath. And like, I really like that. And so, cause it causes all the things we do have or buy are quality and they last and we don't have a lot of excess. And I love the kind of life we lived and we worked hard to get here. And it was just like, yeah, if I would have been focused all these years on making $5 million cash by this date, I would be in a very different place right now.
Sure.
Instead, I get to wake up every day and spend my time doing work I love and hanging out with people that I enjoy hanging out with, like the guy on the other side of this mic.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really well said, and I think that I agree with you there. Like, I don't need my life to look like a rap video. I am aware of the fact that there are boundaries that I wish weren't there, and those are boundaries that, you know, affect the way decisions are made, and those boundaries are created by money a lot of the time. And I think just recognizing that and being honest about that is really important. I think just to back up a little bit, my real self-improvement work didn't begin until I was, you know, 35 years old. I made a lot of self-improvement kind of moves before that. I talked about it like I was interested in it and, of course, self-knowledge. But by the time I was like 34 years old, I said, gosh, there's still a lot here for me to do. And it's possible that in many areas, I've even been telling myself a kind of story while not really, you know, digging to the roots of what's wrong. And when it comes to comfort zones, you know, I try to get uncomfortable one zone at a time. And over, you know, the last couple years, it's been socially. I was very concerned, like, I was living somewhere temporarily in 2014, and I was sitting at my desk one day, and I said, I don't think I've talked to a person in 2 weeks. You know, I'm a hermit. I'm a shut-in. And I'm very, you know, I can go out and socialize and get along with people just fine. But there's a kind of inertia. And, you know, I'm not blaming the world in which we live for this, but there's plenty to do at my desk, you know, including talking to other people virtually. But I realized I hadn't talked to a person. I hadn't looked at a person in the eyes and had a meaningful conversation in, you know, at least 10, 15 days at that point in 2014. So I started to really, really push myself, not just to socialize more, but also to spend less time with people who made me feel okay about where I was. I wanted people beyond where I was. And, you know, this create some discomfort, you know, like I participate in a mastermind every Sunday with some people who have, you know, tremendous success doing, pursuing very similar kinds of lifestyles to the one that I pursue. And mm-hmm. it can be a little intimidating. It can be a little discomforting, but I keep going back and I keep exposing myself to it. And I do a lot of that in real life as well. There were people that I used to stay away from, right? Yeah. Like I was on July 4th, I went down and I was riding around in a speedboat in the Marblehead Harbor in Massachusetts with, let's see, whose boat was it? My dad's significant other's daughter's husband. So I don't know. I guess that makes it my brother.
Way to keep track of that line there.
But you know, they both work in media buying. They, you know, they live in this 5,000 square foot house. They have nice cars. They have everything they want. And like, I went to his house, and I remember like when I first met these people, I just this feeling of resentment that would kind of wash over me, like, oh, you know, your job, you go and you buy media, like advertising, kind of advertising consulting for a lot of like really big clients like Harley Davidson. Just kind of turning my nose up at this isn't, you're not helping the world, whatever the story was I was telling myself at the time. But I go there on the 4th of July and I found, I don't know what to attribute it to right now in the moment, but I remember leaving there feeling good that my attitude had changed, that I felt comfortable around people like that, who, like a married couple, you know, a net yearly income of $500,000-$600,000. That was something that was just upsetting to me before, and now it isn't. So I feel out of that comfort zone, or creating a safe space, really, for myself, just like hang around with people who are doing about the same or worse than you. And, you know, another one is like personal relationships, romantic relationships, like trying to get uncomfortable and understand the problems that I've had in those areas as well. But what still looms over me in many ways is the financial. And it's not like there's a struggle, but it's just, gosh, you know, I'm realizing that the present for me is the accumulation of a lot of poor financial decisions in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the next thing that I'm really trying to dig into.
So I'm wondering, like, what happened that you were able to feel, you know, comfortable around these people that were always obviously making a lot more money?
Exposure. What? Exposure. I think it was continuous exposure over the course of you know, a couple of years, and actively seeking more of those types of people. I don't know who says you're the average of the five people that you hang around with the most, but I just became aware of the fact that I was making some bad decisions about who to hang around with, you know, and that was really showing up in romantic relationships, you know, like choosing people, like there was something that would just go, ah, I'm better off than they are. You know, like even just financially or where I was in my career, there was some kind of intimidation about, you know, not being able to answer that question in the affirmative. So deliberately trying to challenge myself, you know, sitting at home saying, I don't want to go, or I don't want to hang around with that person, and then going and doing it and saying, this means you got to go do it. It paid off over time. Now, I've always been around people who were, you know, successful. And, you know, one of my best friends is a very, very wealthy guy, but it was a hard thing to sustain. But I think that's what it was. I think that's that just making that a practice over the course of a few years made a difference in how because I could measure it against two different experiences with the same people, you know, feeling resentment going to a Christmas party at their house in like 2012 and then feeling excited that this guy had just done this amazing basement renovation and he had the coolest pool table I had ever seen. And really not just like going through the motions, but like feeling good about it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting conversation because you basically what I hear, you know, what we're saying, I think, is that there needs to be this balance of contentment and discontentment, you know, in your current situation. I mean, the formula for change is dissatisfaction plus first steps times action equals change, basically. And so, like, there does have to be a bit of a dissatisfaction with where you are, but at the same time, you do have to be at least you know, satisfied or, you know, and gracious or grateful for your current situation to be happy. So
right.
It's interesting. I'm just trying to think, you know, what, cause that for like the past, there was like a 3-year period where I was constantly comparing myself to people my same age, kind of like you were saying, cousins that run multi-million dollar companies and even my dad, like, hey dad, how much money were you making when you were, you know, 25 years old? And then various friends and stuff like that. And there was this pressure. And then I guess there's such a truth to that saying, you're the average of the 5 people you hang around, because I've reached a point in my life where I'm content and happy with the way things are, but I'm also happy with the way they're progressing. And I have friends to where, yeah, I say like I'm happy and content today, but I do have friends that I see and business partners that I hang out with on a regular basis who are continually working to improve their lives, and to be better, and you know, and even, you know, just to make more money sometimes. And that, because I hang around them so much and I identify in that friendship so much, that still kind of causes me to wake up and almost kind of see, okay, well, where are they at? What kind of moves are they making? And I almost have to make similar moves. But it's not to this point of where I guess I'm dissatisfied,
mm-hmm.
Or jealous, even. And so I say this phrase at the end of every single episode I've ever produced, and it's stay hungry, stay foolish. And it's kind of, it's a phrase taken but from Steve Jobs, who stole it from a magazine, but he's the one that really made it famous. But there's such a principle, and I guess that's what it comes down to, is a principle. There's a principle behind the phrase stay hungry, stay foolish. You know, stay hungry means that even if you're at this point in your life where you are satisfied, you found a way to be grateful and happy with what you have and the kind of life you lead, even if you don't feel like it, you're like, stay hungry. You know, there's a principle there. What's next for you? What's the next goal? And stay foolish, of course, is just like, don't ever get to the point where you think you've got it all figured out, or you're not willing to take another risk on something.
Right.
And so maybe that's what it comes down to. Cause for me, it's a principle. Like I cannot feel happy just things staying the way they are. Like they could stay the way they are, and I would, like, I'm taken care of. Like we can live indoors, like you said, and eat good food and travel a couple times a year, and for the most part, spend our time in the way we want to. But there's just such like this. If I sit for too long, there's like this inner tendency, this inner just something's got to happen. Like I've got to start rustling something up somewhere. And I didn't always have that. So I will say, if anybody is at that point, I will say I used to be that way too. And I honestly think it's because of the people that I've, like you said, Brett, the people that I've chosen to hang around with that maybe have more of a natural tendency. Like my business partner, it's like he is depressed when things are going well, like when everything is going his way and life is just kind of humming along.
Uh-huh.
Like he's not himself. It's like when crap hits the fan and everything's up in the air and there's too much to do and too little time to do it, that's when like he thrives and he's alive. And I'm typically the exact opposite of that. And so seeing that, I get to take a little bit of that into myself almost, because I've been with him for so long as a business partner. And I get a kind of, now I've kind of developed a bit of an innate ability to, like, yeah, okay, I haven't kind of tried to rustle anything up for a few days. You know, let's get another opportunity on the horizon here and try to grow the empire some more.
Yeah,
I hope some of that makes sense. I'm figuring
absolutely.
It out.
Yeah, no, yeah, and that's really interesting, because I'm thinking maybe I need to be exposed to more of that, because if you ask me, like, what makes me feel good, the honest answers are like predictability, equilibrium, you know. And do I want my show to grow? Of course. Do I want it to become more popular and more impactful? Of course. Do I want more people to support it financially? You bet. But the only evolution in like the content or the style came from a kind of boredom, I guess, that I had. Like, I don't want to do that anymore. How could I do something better? How could I do something cooler? Right. But it was never, it didn't get in the way of that priority of equilibrium, right? Like, there's a relief in going, huh, all right, well, I guess this is how things work. Terrific. Now I know how things work, you know? And I think that that's got to be pretty common, because someone will stay in the same place, even though they hate it, right? I mean, the two lessons, right, back to my dad, the two lessons that he taught me that he made clear over and over again, working for other people sucks. And as soon as you don't like doing something, find something else to do. And I followed that advice. But, you know, I guess there is still something stuck there where it's like working for other people sucks. And when you don't like doing something, change it. And I kind of look at some of the hardships that he had. There was buy-in in action, but not like full buy-in in belief about that. Because he had this, he ran this company, or he didn't run it into the ground. It ran him into the ground. And then he went on to be like a CEO at some company that did the same thing that the previous company had done before the printed circuit board catastrophe. He just went back to the industry that he knew, back to the, you know, head executive position that he had held in another company for a while anyway. And then he tried some different things. But what was the point? Yeah, I mean, I think that confronting those comforts or those aspects of myself are important if I ever want to push through them.
You know what? What it might be is maybe just resetting your horizon. Because as you were talking, I'm remembering just some realizations I've had just very recently. Because I've actually just recently struggled with this. So for the last, you know, from when we started our first business for the next 4 years, it was just like every day what drove me to get out of bed was A, I need to make enough money to at least, like, we need to stay in a house and we need to, right, like, be able to feed ourselves and have a little bit of money for some recreational stuff. And then, you know, B, the next thing was my ultimate dream was to move back to the mountains. Like, this was mine and my wife's dream location. And so, like, every morning we'd get up and we say our kind of look over our goals and say our affirmations together. We have a family kind of mission statement. And this was part of that. Like, we will by, you know, X date, which was like 5 years in the future, you know, buy a lot and build our dream like cabin up in the woods. And so for the longest time, those two things were like, that's what got me out of bed to keep building businesses and keep things running. And then basically, long story short, what happened is we moved up there a lot sooner than we thought. And it's because there was a house that came on the market as a foreclosure that my family took advantage of. And it caused us to be able to move up there a lot sooner than we had planned. It was just an out of the blue opportunity. We basically expected it not to go through for the longest time. And then it did. And then all of a sudden, like within 90 days, we had moved to our dream location. Now, not necessarily like our dream house or anything, but our dream location.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, then I remember this period now, just thinking back recently, it's like, well, now what? Like, what gets me out of bed? And then, you know, financially, we're to the point where it's like, okay, we don't have to worry about where our next paycheck is going to come from, you know, every month, and we can pay for all of our basic necessities and then some. So, you know, A and B, like driving factors, this is what got me out of bed, all of a sudden disappeared in like 90 days. And so then that is when I could see what we're talking about, where it becomes very easy to just be like, okay, now I can really almost kick back and enjoy and kind of coast along here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and coast. I think great word, coast.
Yeah, coast. And I think for me, and I actually did that. Like, I did that for probably a good, like, 3 months. We just really enjoyed being up there. And I think that was well-deserved. But then after that, I remember wrestling for a long period of time. Like, okay, well, now what gets me out of bed, sort of thing. And what that's turned out to be so far is just seeing more people change, I guess, is the best way to put it. Like, the things that really drive me are lifestyle and people change. Like, I love people contacting me who listen to the show and emailing me all sorts of questions. And there's some of my listeners I've emailed back and forth, you know, 10, 20 times on a giant email thread. And they've showed these emails to their parents, and like I love that, and so I want more of that. I want more exposure and to impact positively more people. So right now that's kind of what drives me, but there is a hole there. And to be quite honest, I've been looking for, when I mentioned earlier that we were looking at starting a new venture or two, it's because there's a hole. There's something else I need to start, something else that needs to drive me, and I'm still trying to figure out what that is. So there's some real world experience that maybe illustrates the point a little better.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I've actually, you know, I'm telling stories of my past, and I've come to the same place, you know, and I've been talking about that with people lately. I'm saying there's something needs to change. Something needs to get shaken up right now or soon. And that's interesting. I don't know. Sometimes I wish that had come sooner, but it comes when it does, I guess. And, yeah. You know, I think another interesting thing is you're married, right?
Yes.
And if I see this with so many successful people that I know, and it doesn't mean we're not talking, you know, church and marriage license and ring on the finger, but having that kind of person in your life that motivates you, inspires you to do better, that you're both accountable to keep moving forward. I think that has to just be such a tremendous asset for both people. And I've never been married, you know? So I'm also thinking, that's interesting. I do see a pattern emerging there with, now, obviously, marriage is not a panacea for anything, I promise. But if you have two people who are on the same course and have the same priorities, that just has to be like a really amazing thing to have that connection. And whether we're talking about marriage or not, but, you know, moving forward and spending your life with that one person, it has to just be a tremendous, if I didn't use the word asset already, I feel like I used it 30 seconds ago, but a tremendous asset.
Dude, I think we found it. I think we just need to get you married, man.
All right. That's fine.
Any eligible bachelorettes listening, give Brett a call.
Here. I'll conduct my own search.
I think you hit it on the head there, man, because again, I think at a basic level it comes down to like who you're around all the time. And obviously if you're married, your spouse is the person you're around the most. And so my wife is, she's entrepreneurial. She runs basically single-handed, well, not single-handedly, I should say, but she runs with my business partner's wife, two of our businesses. She does all that, and she's just finished writing a book, and she has a podcast. And so like we're very much on the same page as far as that goes. So we are, like you said, I guess, really able to push each other and hold each other accountable. I'm in the very early stages of writing a book right now, and so she's like just always on me to, because I've been procrastinating on that. She's always telling me to write, and so that, I guess, in addition to the few kind of close friends I have and business partners, is I've gotta just attribute most of where I'm at right now, and then where I'm thinking I'm gonna go, to those relationships. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you watch, like, there's this crazy long study about what makes people happy, and they studied a bunch of people over like 70 years, and this guy just recently gave a TED talk on it, and there's only a few people left, you know, alive that originally participated in this study. And the scientists were basically interviewing them all throughout, you know, these 70 years plus, every year maybe, or maybe every decade, asking them a bunch of questions to ultimately find out what made them happy. And this has gone through like multiple, I guess, just researchers or scientists have, you know, died or retired, and it's been passed on. And so it's amazing that this study's existed for so long. But their main finding was, is that people, the biggest factor for long-term happiness was relationships and family as well. You know, when everything is kind of stripped away, and or when people are on their deathbed, or you know, people are getting towards the end of their lives, when they look back, it's typically a lot of it is how they spent their time, but mostly like who they spent their time with that makes the biggest impact on not just their happiness, but I think their overall success or misery. So I think you hit it on the head there. And so if you do find yourself at a place where you're going to get married, that's like, that's crucial, man. You got to get somebody who's aligned with you and somebody you're ultimately, I think, best friends with at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting. Like the time I've spent single, like being over 30, I've tried to like go out more, you know, even just for life experience with women, you know, and just see what it is about people that I like and what I don't. And what I've learned by this point is I don't like going out on dates and feeling like I'm being interviewed. And that certainly has happened, like for a job. But, yeah. You know, my interview questions that are really important to me are, what do you do? Why do you do it? And how much do you love it? Right. Because if you get the wrong answers, especially to, you know, the last question, then that's not a recipe for success or harmony I have found. The choices that I've made in life, which have involved at times sacrificing a little bit of security that I could have had in most jobs in the facsimile education world. I could have been right now the principal of a school. So, yeah. But I traded that, you know, whatever, great benefits package and $130,000 a year years ago to get off that track and, first of all, work in private education that I thought was, you know, lucrative, but less lucrative and way more helpful, and eventually transitioning into what I do now. So the last thing I want is to wind up with somebody who comes home and says, God, you know, this coworker is the most petty person and the schedule at the office is all screwed up because, you know, this lady who's in charge of scheduling, I could be sitting in an office in, a bad suit dealing with all that if I wanted to and making a lot more money. And I just don't want to deal with it. I don't have any place in my life for any of that stuff. So that's made me, while on the one hand, trying to get out and have more experiences, being increasingly judicious, especially as I get older, about who I'm willing to have them with.
And I think ultimately, man, that's the right way to go. I mean, so many people just do things because of the money, or like we've been saying, you know, society tells you to, or it's the good decision, but so little of life is about money. And really, when you get into like what money is, and it's like, it doesn't even have any really intrinsic value. It's just a value that society places on it. And that everybody kind of just agrees it has this value. And yeah, I would so much rather live a life of being true to myself and maybe not fitting into societal norms as much, but just being a little bit more content with life.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about that is too, though, is that you're typically, well, still these days, you're still an outlier if you do that. And so you typically can have an easier time, I think, attracting quality people to your cause and an audience and stuff like that, which obviously you've been able to do.
Yeah, I think about money too as a tool, you know, and sometimes money is just like a car or a screwdriver, right? Like if you've ever tried to change a license plate on your car without a screwdriver, I mean, you can do it. You can figure out a way to do it, but there's an opportunity cost in time, right? I could live without a car and still get everywhere. I design a life around that. But sometimes I just say, I'm here thinking about point B. You know, I'm here at point A. I'm thinking about point B a lot. And now I'm there with a snap. So I have learned through different like levels of economic comfort through my life that money does work to that end. Sometimes it can just solve a problem that allows you to get back to like, a place that you want to be. Something like actually spending your time the way you want or doing the things you want. And you don't have to, there's trade-offs that don't have to be considered. So
yeah,
I think it does have importance But you're right. I've watched people too who design their entire lives and lifestyles around the money that they make. Mm-hmm. And it's and I think I did that once too, right? Like I when I first started making a lot of money working in private education just as a service provider, working for a company in the Boston area, I never worried about money more because it was the like I was telling myself a story that, oh, this is better work than what I was doing. And I think it was, but I was doing it for the money, you know? And when that becomes your purpose, you get really hyper-focused on it, and it can be pretty stressful.
Yeah, so, I mean, an interesting point to that effect is a lot of people are focused on the monthly cash, right? And they trade their time, in terms of maybe going to school, getting a degree, and in that respect, you know, making bad investments and, with student debt and everything in order to get this monthly cash flow, you know, this golden, you know, salary kind of standard that everybody looks for, or even a yearly mm-hmm. income. And that's what people right. focus on. And it's like, even to this day, I have a lot of close friends who are in more traditional jobs or career paths who make more money on a monthly and even yearly basis than I do. And if you look through my financial, you know, history, it's like, okay, you made no money for like a year, and then there's a large chunk. Okay, and then that, you know, gets spread out upon, you know, it's used as a tool, and then it's saved or invested, and then, you know, I make nothing, and then there's a large chunk. And so I think a lot of it is this really traditional view of cash flow, where it's got to be this monthly consistent cash flow, and then people use that for living expenses, and very little of it is actually, and they think about it in terms of, I need this cash flow for living life,
mm-hmm.
And instead of this mindset of, I need cash to use as a tool to put into appreciating the assets that will build wealth, not just income, but build wealth. You can have a lot of income and not be a wealthy person, right? And so
right.
I think so many people, they think about money the wrong way, and then nobody ever bothers to study money. I mean, money is not just as simple as there's a dollar, I do something for you give me a dollar, and I spend it on something else. It's a very complicated tool. It's not, you know, we're talking about it, it's like a screwdriver or something. It's more like a fruit sorting machine or something. I don't know. That's, yeah. I have a friend in that industry, and they're very, very complicated machines. That, right? It's like an incredibly multifaceted, complicated tool that can be used to do a variety of different things. And if used right, it can grow and last exponentially and into even future generations. And so don't just think about yourself. So I look at some of my friends who, they're making money, they're buying cool stuff. I'm not making money, I'm not buying cool stuff. But if, say, we fast forward to where both of us are 50, you know, at the risk of sounding something I don't want to sound like, you know, there's a good chance that I might have a stronger net worth, you know, at that point. And what I was saying is that people just don't study money, and there's whole books about you know, money and how it works, and budgeting, man. Budgeting is something that should be taught in schools. It's like, mm-hmm. You think I was a crazy person if you looked at, I have a personal spreadsheet just for our personal finances, and it's like, I account for every single dollar, and I've got this thing down to an incredibly slick system where, you know, at any given moment, and I've had to, it's by necessity. As an entrepreneur, I don't make a monthly income, so I can't live paycheck to paycheck. I've had to save and come up with a budgeting system to where I take an accounting of everything that's going out, everything that's coming in, and everything we still have. And then there's that bottom line there, when all of that is added and subtracted from each other, and that always fluctuates. But looking at that bottom line allows me to make decisions on, okay, we should put money here, we should put more time to this business even though it's not paying us because it might pay off later, and all this stuff. And I'm very I sit down and I work on that spreadsheet and update it every week, actually, on Fridays.
yep.
And that's been incredibly powerful, and it's surprising to me how many people don't do that. And my wife and I, we've lived on we do a cash budgeting system. We've done that for the last 3 or 4 years. So we withdraw a certain amount of cash every beginning of every month. We split that cash up into various envelopes for, say, you know, everything from gas money to entertainment to grocery money. And then we spend money out of those respective envelopes. And when they're, when that money's gone, we stop spending. We go over a little bit sometimes, and we put a lot of stuff on a credit card and then pay it off every month to get the miles. And unfortunately, you can't do much in business without good credit. So there's that too. But man, all that stuff should be taught in school.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been experimenting with a system like that as well. You know, swiping a card is not a deliberative enough process for a lot of us, you know, and I've been dealing more in cash, which does completely change a lot of financial calculations. You know, swiping a card is just so easy and so thoughtless. And you're right. And I've been thinking more, you know, because I mean, most of my thinking has gone towards like cash in. And then when you start paying attention, I can't believe I'm it's okay. It's okay that I'm in my late 30s and saying this like it's revelatory. But when you start paying attention to cash out, I mean, like really paying attention to it, like really scrutinizing it. We're always like kind of paying attention to it because we know what our limits are. But like really starting to, you know, hand people cash, it does make a big difference in sort of the consciousness about what you're doing.
Yeah, you can go to Costco for groceries and spend $200 and swipe a card, but it's such a different experience to pull like $200, $250 cash out and hand it over for groceries. It's like, okay, do we really need this? You know, can we get along with it? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just a helpful mentality. But Brett, as great as this conversation has been, I have another interview coming up here in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm interviewing somebody, but my gosh, man, you're a fun guy to talk to.
Indeed. Likewise, Kylan, we got to keep doing this. I said that our series would be two parts, but we should reconvene quite regularly and keep this conversation going because I love what you're doing. And yeah, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
I'm totally down, man. Your episode got some great traction with the Successful Dropout community as well. So maybe I'll have you on again. And I want to go listen to this episode where you talk a little bit more about your history there. Maybe we'll get you on the show and dive into that a little more. Because and I think I'll probably put this episode up too on my podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds great. Well, I just want to say, while we're still recording, thank you so much for coming on School Sucks and kind of being interviewed. That was more of a back and forth, but I got to learn some things about you that weren't in the first show for sure. And can you just remind everybody in my audience where they can find your work and learn more about you?
Yeah, I'd head over to successfuldropout.com and you'll find everything there. And then my handle everywhere on social media is my first and last name, Kylan Ginger, and you'll probably see that in the title of this episode.
Awesome. All right, Kylan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brett. She got the